get started for the day. The topic which I want to discuss today is an interesting topic. Most of us are not very familiar with it, but it's something which does come up in the Torah very often. And as we talk about mitzvos, there's many mitzvos that pertain to this topic, which is the rules of tumma and tahara, which, for lack of better translation, is spiritual, ritual impurity, ritual purity. Again, it's hard to translate it because pure and impure to us means something very different than tumma tahara would mean. But the Torah calls it tumma tahara, and I think the best translation you're going to get is ritual purity, ritual impurity. Just to define what it is and where it applies, there are many sources that can make somebody tamei. And the primary source would be contact with a dead body, whether it be touching a dead body, whether it be being under the same roof as a dead body, touching somebody who's touched a dead body. This all would cause a person to become tamei, to become ritually impure. Other examples would be certain types of dead animals. There is something called saras, which is the skin condition a person develops, which the rabbis tell us for speaking lashon hara, that was the punishment. A woman's menstruation, any sort of different types of bodily emissions from men or women, etc. There's also rabbinic sources of tumah, such as an idol. It's an idol would make somebody tameh rabbinically, even though the Torah according to the Torah, an idol does not make you tameh, but if you touch an idol rabbinically, you become tameh. And there are other examples as well. These are the primary examples given in the Torah. Now, what it means to be tameh, what it means on a practical level for us nowadays is very little. What it meant in their days is the Torah never gave any prohibition to become tameh. A person's allowed to be tameh. There's a problem with it, per se. Only a Kohen is not allowed to become tameh from a dead body. So as you know, Kohanim will not go to funerals, won't look into cemeteries, they're very careful. Even when they're entering the hospital, things like that, because maybe somebody in the hospital has passed away. So Kohanim are very careful with this, because a Kohen is not allowed to become tameh through a dead body. Any other Jew is allowed to become tameh. It's not a problem, there's no issue with it, there's no prohibition. Unless you wanted to offer a sacrifice or enter into the Beis HaMikdash, into the temple grounds. If you want to enter into the temple grounds or to offer a sacrifice, you had to be tahor, to be pure. So in daily life, it did not really affect a person, unless you're a Kohen. But when you're ready to go bring a sacrifice to the temple or eat of the sacrificial meats, you had to be tahor, you had to be pure. The Rambam, Maimonides, points out that in other ancient religions in his days, they also had these concepts as well of tumah tahara. But he says that they were much more stringent in a way which would inconvenience people's lives. I mean, the Rambam writes about these ancient religions that basically people who were tameh would kind of be shut indoors, they couldn't do anything, and making somebody impure, they became impure from many more sources than the Torah prescribes. And it wasn't only, and the impurity didn't only affect them in terms of sacrifice, but it affected them in their daily life. And that really was quite tedious and inconvenient to live life like that. So the Torah recognizes that. The Torah does have a concept of impurity, but it doesn't become a nuisance because it only affects you if you wanted to go into the temple. And we'll explain why that is in a minute. So that's the concept of tumah in a general sense. Again, there's no prohibition of tumah, but unless you wanted to offer a sacrifice or enter into the temple grounds. The idea of tumah, impurity, is not really on our minds nowadays. Because since we don't have a temple, we don't offer sacrifices, so it's not really relevant to us. Again, unless you're a Kohen, it's not really relevant to you. If you are a Kohen, then it is relevant in terms of going to funerals, entering cemeteries, and the like. But it's extremely prevalent in the Torah, these discussions. And as we always point out, everything in the Torah, even if it doesn't apply to us on a practical level nowadays, has lessons to offer us. So if you pick up, many, many parts of the Torah discuss concepts of tumah and tahara, purity and impurity, and therefore there must be something which it has to offer us, even nowadays, even when we're not actually living with it in daily life, there has to be some sort of message that offers us.
Question. If you're living in Israel or Jerusalem, are there certain issues of tamei? Maybe there are. What might be there than there are here?
Well, only to enter on the Temple Mount. Besides that, I mean, the issue of entering on the Temple Mount, besides the fact that it's going to cause problems with the Arabs, but according to most authorities, nobody nowadays should be entering the Temple Mount because we're all considered impure nowadays. So therefore, entering the Temple Mount. There are some rabbis, I don't even know what their reasoning is, there are some rabbis who allow it, which has caused also some issues in recent years. But most rabbinic authorities would tell you that you should not, no Jew is allowed to enter the Temple Mount nowadays because every Jew is considered impure. So that's the idea. But it's not so prevalent in our lives. If you just can imagine for a second what it was like in their days, though, whether or not they're allowed to become Tameh, you have to be aware of your status. On the one hand, if you wanted to go to the Temple Mount, you had to know if you were Tameh or Tahor. Also, some people, even though it's okay to become Tameh, were careful to always remain Tahor. It was considered a religious level, a virtue, to remain Tahor at all times, even though it was okay to be Tameh. So therefore, life would be totally different. You know, people would have to know, what's your status? What's the status of this chair? Is this chair Tameh or Tahor? Is this food Tameh or Tahor? Because if I eat or sit on it, it might affect me. And everyone had to be fully aware of the status of themselves and everything around them. So you can imagine that made a major impact on life. You know, I grew up in the South. My parents tell me about the separate water fountains, you know, before the Civil Rights Movement. You can imagine the separate water fountains for a Tameh person, Tahor person. The days of, there were water fountains back then, but that type of idea, that the Tameh entrance, Tahor entrance. You know, you can imagine that, because people had to remain separate. If somebody was Tameh and they touched me, they could affect me. And if I want to remain Tahor, I have to be very careful. So therefore, you can imagine life was very, very heavily impacted by the concepts of Tahoma and Tahara. Again, nowadays it's not relevant to us on that level. But we put ourselves in the mindset of a Jew living 2,000 years ago, it was a major part of daily life. And as we pray, God willing, that God should rebuild the temple, bring the Mashiach, so this will come back into play once again. So even though we're not very familiar with the halachas and how it works, but it does definitely impact daily life when the temple is built, when sacrifices are part of our lives. So
if a Kohen accidentally became Tameh, there was no way to purify.
No, so there is a way to become pure. I mean, the way you become pure would be the ashes of the red cow. The Torah, that's one of the laws in the Torah which we don't fully understand how it works. But the ashes of the red cow would purify a Kohen. We don't have any red cows nowadays. So God will provide for us the red cow.
Red hero.
What?
Red cow, red hero.
Well, it needs to be fully red. All the hairs have to be red. Yeah. Besides, I think you're allowed an allowance maybe of two hairs that are not red.
And that's why it's a big deal. They're recording that red cow was born, might be a sign.
Right, yeah, so no, God
say that,
will...
Say that again, if a red cow is born, what?
Then it could be a sign that Mashiach is coming, is on his way.
Because we return to sacrifices if Mashiach comes?
Right, yeah, we do, because he'll rebuild the temple for us, help us rebuild the temple. So that's something which God will provide at the time when we're ready for it, the red cow. But besides that, you hear reports every once in a while, somebody thinks they have a red cow born, and they find out there's too many black hairs on it, you know? But you do hear these reports periodically of a cow with red hair being born, and everyone gets all excited, and then you find out, okay, but it has eight black hairs, and it's disqualified. You know, that's you hear. That's the way that anybody can become pure. If somebody came to me through touching a dead body, that's the way to become pure. All other types of impurity will typically just require going to the mikvah. There might be a waiting period, no waiting period, but it requires going to the mikvah. The only one that requires the ashes of the red cow would be becoming impure through a dead body. But again, anybody who's ever gone to a funeral in their life is impure from a dead body. Anyone's been on the Chevra Kadisha, anyone's been in a hospital where somebody's passed away. I mean, it's not likely that anybody, any Jew in the world, any person in the world would not have this tumah at this point from a dead body because we're not careful with it. But a Kohen is the only one, maybe, but even a Kohen, many times unbeknownst to them, they do become Tameh. And even a Kohen's allowed to go to the funeral of a close relative, of one of his, you know, a parent, a sibling, a spouse, or a child. So at that point, the Kohen becomes impure, and he won't become purified ever again nowadays because there's no red cow. So even the Kohen nowadays will be impure at a certain point in his life, even if he's been careful his entire life, because it's inevitable that there'll be, you know, let's say his parent will pass away, and he'll go to the funeral, and then he'll become Tameh at that point. So what's the lessons we can learn from the concept of Tumah and Tahara? I mean, we're not going to go through the specific laws, all different sources, that's beyond the scope of our class. But what are some of the lessons and messages we can pull out of this mitzvah? So the Rambam, Maimonides, has an interesting approach. He points out that really the relevance of it was essentially for the Beis HaMikdash, for the temple, and did not impact the rest of our lives, like we mentioned. So he said that it's a fact of human life, psychologically, that we are more impacted by those things that we don't do as often. Things that become routine, they become rote, we do them all the time, they're not as exciting, they don't impact us, they don't make an impression on us in the same way, it's something we do only periodically. For instance, you know, somebody who lives at the ocean is not enthralled by the ocean. somebody who goes to see the ocean once every 3 years, we see the ocean, say, wow, that's incredible, it's gorgeous, it's beautiful, look at the size, hear the waves. But if you have a house on the beach, you're living there all year long, so the ocean doesn't mean much to you. So that's how we are. And that even applies halachically. There's a special bracha, a blessing we make when we see the ocean. But if you see, that's only if you haven't seen it in 30 days. You saw the ocean 2 days ago and you see it again, you don't make a new blessing because it doesn't impact you. You're not excited about it. Because the thrill is only there if it comes on a periodic basis. If you're there every single day, you don't have the thrill anymore. So Rambam writes that entering the Beis HaMikdash was supposed to be a very, very powerful experience. It should be very inspiring, very motivating. It should really impact a person. If you're entering the Beis HaMikdash all day long, every day, all the time, so it would lose its excitement. It loses impact. It's been there, done that. You know, it's same old, every single day. So therefore, the Rambam writes that God puts limitations upon who, when, and how you can enter into the Beis HaMikdash. And he says, if somebody is Tameh, then you can't enter in. Why? Because that will make it a more rare experience for a person. You have to, number one, you have to prepare. You have to achieve that level of Tahara, of purity, and then you have to go. Because the sources of tumma in life are actually very common. So, therefore, these are things which everybody could not just walk in anytime they wanted to this mikvah. They had to prepare themselves. Okay, what's my status today? Do I have to go to the mikvah? Do I have to go get the ashes of the red heifer sprinkled upon me? Now I have to wait till nighttime or tomorrow. There are different halachas for each type of source of tumma. But overall, it means that entering the mikvah cannot be a constant for a person because inevitably we'll all become tumma and we'll have to wait and go through a purification process. So we want the Beis HaMikdash not to lose, you know, its glamour, its inspiration, its impact upon us. So therefore, we make it a more rare experience by having the laws of Tumah and Tahara. We can relate to it also on a very simple level. You know, it's a very hot day, and you walk into an air-conditioned building, you say, wow, that feels great. If you sit in the building for an hour, you don't appreciate the air conditioning anymore. Because once it becomes a constant, you no longer appreciate it. But if you're in the heat and you walk into the air, you say, wow, that is so, feels so good, and you're so appreciative of being in a cold, air-conditioned room. So that's what the Beis HaMikdash is like, that if you're there all the time, it can certainly lose its appeal, its inspiration. If you're only there periodically, so then it inspires you. So therefore, all these sources of tumma exist, the Rambam says, in order to make the experience of entering into the temple and experiencing sacrifice as a more rare experience in our lives. Now, there are certain times of year every Jew had to appear in the temple, such as the three pilgrimage festivals. And therefore, at those times, everybody would have to go through a purification process in order so they could enter in. Those are the three times a year. The rest of the year, no one had to go unless you had a sacrifice to offer. And when you did, you'd have to go through a purification process, know your status, and enter with the proper mindset. So we have to view this as a special event to enter into the Beis HaMikdash, not just an everyday routine. Keep it powerful so we appreciate it. Only in that way will entering into the temple really impact the person, bring them to the reverence of God and the humility that it's supposed to actually engender in a person. Really, when you walk in there, you should be just enthralled by the sea, and you should say, wow, I feel the holiness here. I see the Kohanim doing their service. I see the beauty of the building. I hear the beautiful music of the Levites. You should walk in there and just be totally inspired. But if you're there every single day, it's not going to inspire you. So God says, let's space out the trips. And therefore, you're going to have to get yourself ready and come in only when you are prepared. And so that's what the Rambam says is the meaning of this mitzvah. The lesson behind this mitzvah is to kind of space out your trips to the temple. Now, we can definitely draw out lessons from this. Now, it doesn't mean that we're supposed to skip out on mitzvahs or Jewish observances just to make them fresh in our minds. Obviously not. It doesn't mean skip out on going to shul so that shul is exciting for you. You should still be there to shul every single day, wherever you can. But the idea is that don't let things become old news. Things should not become stale in our minds. As soon as a mitzvah becomes stale, it loses its impact. We don't get the inspiration out of it. We have to make sure that things always remain fresh. And the way the Torah says that when the Torah predicts the destruction of Jerusalem and the exile of the Jews, the term used is v'noshantem arf. You're going to become old in the land. So commentaries point out that v'noshantem has the implication of you're going to be stale. Mitzvahs are going to become very stale to you. The idea of yashan, something which is aged, something old, you know, something which we'd say kind of stale in a certain sense. The Jews, they're in Israel for so long, they lost their excitement in Torah observance, they lost the inspiration. It didn't have its freshness to it. So they become very stale there. And God said, well, that's going to cause you to sin and to lead to your destruction. That's what God told them. That's predicted in the book of Devarim, in Parshas Vayeshanan. So therefore, we have to strive to always introduce some freshness and excitement to our Torah observance. the Rashi tells us that it says in Shema, we say in Shema, these words which I command you on this day should be on your heart. So Rashi points out, what does it mean on this day? So Rashi says that God's telling us in the words of Shema, on this day means that every day is as if it's brand new to you. The words I command you on this day, every day the Torah I receive, the Torah I study, the Torah that I observe is brand new to me today. Because you always have to have that fresh attitude towards Torah observance. Practically, how do we accomplish that? So I would suggest, you know, having some new thought, some new insight into what you're doing makes a big difference. So let's say somebody feels that tefillah, prayer, is getting kind of old and stale for them. So a lot of times, if you have a new understanding of prayer, a new thought to bring into your prayers, and we'd rather it not be a new need. I mean, a lot of times also our prayers become more heartfelt when there's a need. When somebody is sick, God forbid, or somebody needs to make a living, and we know somebody who's in need, so then our prayers become a little more powerful. We don't want to have that to inspire our prayers. But to understand, have a deeper understanding of the prayers, a new thought, a new perspective on life, which I can bring into my davening. So that gives an element of freshness, and then my davening never becomes stale. If a mitzvah, let's say, you know, Shabbos, it comes every single week, and Shabbos, sometimes the routine of Shabbos can become just part of the routine. But we want to make Shabbos inspiring for ourselves. So to have a new insight into Shabbos, pick up a book about Shabbos, read a short new insight about Shabbos, and next Shabbos, you'll be living Shabbos a little differently because you have a new insight into Shabbos now. And we can't let mitzvahs in terms of service become routine, become stale, become rote, become old, or else, you know, it's a slippery slope. It leads to lack of observance, it leads to lack of inspiration, and it no longer feels good to be observing mitzvahs if they're stale to you. So the lesson of Tumah Tahara, one lesson is to keep mitzvahs fresh. And just like the Beis Hamikdash, the experience should always be a fresh, inspiring, new experience to us, so too we should strive to perform that way in every single mitzvah. That every single mitzvah should always become a new, fresh, inspiring experience in our everyday life. So that's one approach you have to Tumah Tahara based on the Rambam. Now the other approach I want to share with you today is from the Sefer HaChinuch, which we quote often. Sefer HaChinuch is the book which goes through 613 mitzvahs one by one, explains the laws, explains the meaning. And very often, when he feels fit, he'll give you an intro, a more general intro to a certain mitzvah. So he doesn't always just go into a specific mitzvah and say, this is what it's all about. Many times, he'll give you a general introduction, a general perspective that'll help you understand this particular mitzvah. And the Sefer HaChinuch, I probably mentioned it before, was written by a father for his son. He saw his son was kind of not paying attention in class, he was being a little mischievous. This is, we're talking about probably 600-700 years ago. So he said, okay, I'm going to write you a book. And this book's going to help you focus in on your studies, let you spend your time appropriately so you don't waste your time, you don't bump around with everybody else. You're going to have a book you can read. I'm going to write you an interesting book. So he wrote him the Sefer HaChinuch, which became a classic. This very, very quickly became a classic Jewish work. I'm discussing every single mitzvah. So sometimes you see him talking personally to his son. He'll say, listen up, my child, you know, you might be tempted to do this, but, you know, the Torah teaches this. And you'll feel like some sort of connection from the author to the reader based on him speaking to his child. But the Sefer HaChinuch on the mitzvah, when he first discusses the idea of Tumah Tahara, of the ritual purity, impurity, he gives a very general perspective on Torah and mitzvahs in general. And he's recognizing the fact that the concept of Tumah and Tahara is kind of beyond us. Like the fact that I touched a dead cow, why does that affect me in any way? I mean, a dead cow, a nevela, if it wasn't slaughtered properly, makes somebody tame. So why should that make me tame? You know, the fact that I'm in the same room as a dead body, like, okay, you know, we believe in respecting a mace. You know, Chevra Kadisha, we look at it as the highest honor for a person. That's one of the greatest chasadim you can do, the kindness that you show someone else after they pass away. That's considered the highest level of kindness. So how come being in the same room as a dead body makes someone impure? We don't really understand how it works. Understand how it affects a person. So that's the perspective he takes in the beginning of discussing this mitzvah. And he said that we have to understand something very important. No human being can understand everything about the world. No, we are not God. There's a God, he understands it all, and we're not God. We're creations of God. And we have our limits. He says even Moshe, even Moses himself, who we feel understood as much as a human being can possibly understand, he writes that the Gemara tells us that there are 50 gateways of understanding, and even Moshe only understood 49 of them. There's still one gateway of understanding even Moshe cannot understand. even Shlomo, King Solomon, who we look at as the wisest of all men who ever lived, and he himself admits that it says in the book of Kohelet, Ecclesiastes, Echkama, I said I will become wise, but it was distant from me. Even Shlomo says true wisdom was beyond him. He couldn't understand everything. So you take the two human beings we probably hold up and say these are the wisest of human beings to ever walk on the face of the earth, Moshe and Shlomo, King Solomon, and both of them could not achieve full wisdom. They got really far, they understood a lot, but not everything. So Sefer Chinuch writes that we have to understand that the only being that knows everything is God. God understands all, everything God does is with a reason, it's for our benefit, but the human being is going to be limited, and the human being cannot possibly understand everything. So you trust that God knows what he's doing, and whatever it says in the Torah that's right or wrong to do is right or wrong to do. And if we don't understand why, we say, I don't understand why, but God knows. And we throw up our hands and we say that I don't know everything. You know, like I'm a human being and I'm limited. Even Moshe was limited. You know, you look at Moshe, even Moshe couldn't understand everything. But we know that everything has its reason, it's there for our benefit. And this is really the approach one should take to all mitzvahs. You know, the Torah starts with God, not with me. And I think it's something in modern American society which we miss sometimes. Because the modern American attitude is that everything starts with me. Will it be good for me or not? Does it make sense to me or not? And therefore I accept it or reject it based on that. Religion is something, well, if it feels good, if it fits me, I'll take it on. If it doesn't fit me, then, you know, I'm not interested. I'll do something else. That's really a very modern-day approach, which we have. Very American approach. I mean, even democracy is kind of built on that. What the people want. There's no higher ideal per se. But if people decide they want, that's what they do. So you get 51% of a vote, then no holds barred. Everything is fine because you got the vote. So that's really our attitude. But really, the Torah teaches us the opposite. The Torah starts from God. And step one is that God is the wisdom of the world. God knows all. God is infinite. And God is knows everything. And he understands far beyond that which we can understand. And therefore, you don't start rating mitzvahs based on your understanding. We're supposed to try our best to understand a mitzvah. And if we understand it, that's definitely a great thing. And that helps us in our observance. That helps us in growing as people. If we don't understand it, it doesn't mean, well, I don't get it, so it's not relevant to me. The Jewish approach is, well, the Torah begins as God's will and God's word. And whether I understand it or not, that's irrelevant in terms of my observance. And I should strive my entire life to understand the Torah as best as possible. But there are going to be parts of the Torah which I'll never get. Even Moshe didn't understand the whole Torah. Even King Solomon didn't understand the whole Torah. And that's okay, because we trust that since it's from God, then it's the right thing to do. And whatever it is, it's beneficial for me. We don't say, well, it doesn't make sense to me, because God will say, well, who are you? You don't know. You don't know what you're talking about. I mean, look at, sometimes you'll have, a four-year-old ask a question. And you can explain it to the four-year-old, and they're not going to understand a word you're saying, you know? So they'll say, I don't get it, so I'm not going to do it. No, the parent knows that this is the right thing to do. Try to explain to a three-year-old why it's important to brush your teeth. You know, you talk about the hygiene and cavities and rotting gums and root canals. They don't know what you're talking about. So you just say, just do it because it's the right thing. You'll figure it out later. You'll understand when you grow up. You know, and that's the approach we take with God also. That some things God says you're not going to get. You understand? There's a much bigger picture out there which human beings are not privy to. But just do it. It's good for you. And eventually you understand. Hopefully we'll all understand. But that has to be our approach to Torah. So you take a mitzvah such as Tumah and Tahara, they say it's not rational to us. It doesn't really make sense how it works. Why these things make you impure? What does it mean to be impure? Why does it affect you if you're impure? Why does jumping in a mikvah make you pure? Why the ashes of a red cow do it have any effect on a person? It doesn't make any sense to us. It's not rational. It's not logical. But this is an area where we say, well, God knows. God knows best. God knows all. We don't. Even Moshe didn't. So for sure, we don't know everything. And we listen. And we say that we try our best to understand it. We put forth our best efforts to know what this mitzvah means. But at a certain point, where we draw a line and we say, well, I can't understand past that. It doesn't make any more sense to me. And maybe we'll try through our whole lives to understand it. And if we don't, it's also okay. So we already saw the Rambam gave us some rationale to the mitzvah to keep things in the Beis HaMikdash pure and exciting. But he didn't tell us, well, why do these things make you impure? Why not other things? And how come the process of purity comes through this method or that method or this many days or that many days? We don't understand all the details, even according to the Rambam's explanation. So the Sefer Chinuch writes here too, if we don't understand a mitzvah, we should feel humble before God and acknowledge that God's wisdom is beyond us. If we understand it, we should be happy. If we understand a mitzvah, we should rejoice that we have some taste of God's wisdom. And even that which we understand, we don't see the full picture. We understand mitzvahs on this level, but the mitzvah has a level which goes even deeper and deeper and deeper. And we'll never understand the deepest level of mitzvah. We know the Torah comes in layers, and there's the various surface level, and there's deeper layer, and there's Kabbalistic layers and mystical layers, and there's layers which are theoretical and conceptual and practical. There's so many layers in the Torah. And we can understand the Torah on one layer, two layers, three layers, four layers, but there's going to be a certain layer where our understanding stops. We know because this is God's wisdom, God's Torah, there's deeper layers there also, which we're not going to get. And you might find, you know, the greatest Torah sage or the greatest Kabbalist, and he might understand it up to layer number 64. But he doesn't get 65 or 67. I mean, there's more and more layers to understand, and those layers are constantly getting deeper and deeper. And hopefully we've all realized throughout our lives that which we understood when we were younger, hopefully we understand on a deeper level and deeper level. And even a mitzvah which we may have been taught when we were 8 years old, hopefully when we turn 20, 30, or 40, we understand that at a deeper level now. So hopefully we've all experienced that going deeper into the Torah to some degree. But there's a limit of the human mind. So that which we understand, we should be very happy. We feel grateful to God that He granted us that wisdom, and we should appreciate it and let that inspire us. If we don't understand it, so we can acknowledge that God's beyond us, become humble, be humble before God, and move on. And don't let it affect our observance, because it's from God. If it's from God, that means it's the right thing to do. The Gemara tells us that there are three mitzvahs that the Torah specified a reason for. And let me grab that. And King Solomon himself took those reasons a little bit too far, and because of that he sinned. I'll read to you what it says. This is in the Talmud, it's Maseches Sanhedrin. The Torah gives limitations for what kings can do. Right? And the Torah says the king should not take too many wives, the king should not have too much money, the king should not have too many horses. As opposed to non-Jewish emperors who would take as much as they possibly could. The Jewish king was commanded by the Torah to limit his wealth, limit his wives, and limit his army, limit his horses, etc. So it says here, let me find it for you, that King Solomon himself wives, money, and horses. Yeah. Wives, money, and horses. I'm trying to find for the...
what Gemara are you?
This is in Sanhedrin 21a. But I can't find the exact quote here. But essentially... The idea is that the Torah, when it discusses the laws of a king, it describes why not. Why can't he have too much money? Why can't he have too many wives? Why can't he have too many horses? And let's just take one example. So it says, don't have too many wives because they might lead you astray. That's what it says. King Solomon said, well, the Torah says they might lead you astray. What?
You don't need many for that.
Make it snap by women around you. Be careful. So let's take one example. The Torah says that the wives won't lead you astray. Don't take too many wives, they may lead you astray. So King Solomon said, well, you know, I'm very wise, I'm very righteous, so it doesn't apply to me. Because the Torah says the reason is not applicable to me, so he got married to many, many wives, it says in the prophets.
Well,
the limit given, I mean, it still sounds like a lot. I believe it's 18. Yeah. For a king. Yeah.
They don't have 90 wives. 18 is
your cutoff. You read about these ancient kings, though. They had hundreds of wives. I mean, concubines, wives, everything else.
Concubines and wives are different.
Yeah, but they had everything. I mean, they had both. In those days.
Oh, you're right. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it was part of right. So it says not too many wives. King Solomon said, well, you know what, they're not going to affect me. I'm so wise, I'm so righteous. I can have as many wives as I like, it's not going to be a problem. And I can't find the quote here, but it says at the end of his life, here it is. So Shlomo said that, it's actually on 21b, I was looking at 21b. So Shlomo said that the Torah says, don't have too many wives, they may lead you astray. Shlomo said, well, I'll have lots of wives, and it won't cause me a problem. And then it says in the Book of Kings that when Shlomo became older, his wives led him astray. It says explicitly. His wives started building altars to idols, and he did not stop them. He's blamed for it. Shlomo, it says in the Torah, you shouldn't have too many horses if you're the king. Shlomo said, don't worry. It says, why can't you have too many horses? It says, because you may go back to Egypt to get more horses. You're not supposed to return to Egypt. The Jews left Egypt through miracles. You're not supposed to go back to Egypt. And Egypt was known for their horses. So the Torah says, don't have too many horses, because lest you have to go back to Egypt to get more horses. And Shlomo said, don't worry, I'll have plenty of horses. I'm not concerned about having to go to Egypt to buy horses. But yet it says in the Book of Kings that he took a load of chariots and horses out of Egypt. So it gives other examples as well. But we see, what's pointed out here is that even the reasons we understand about mitzvahs, if God explained to us more, it might lead us astray as well. Because we'll say, well, that's the reason. It doesn't apply anymore to me, so then I don't have to worry about this mitzvah. And look, even somebody like King Solomon, once he said that, it did apply to him. And you can't make that decision on your own, because God knows better. Yeah.
Excuse my ignorance, what I'm about to say. This is the first I'm hearing that a mitzvah could be not doing something. I've thought up until this moment a mitzvah was doing something. Now I'm hearing, I said I'm ignorant. I qualified that. So, but now I'm hearing a mitzvah is sometimes not doing something. So when we pray daily for keep us away from evil inclination, is that a mitzvah if we don't involve in? How do we make a distinction between?
The word mitzvah means a command of God. The command might be
mitzvah
don't.
Is a command.
Yeah, it's a commandment. That's something I try to point out. Right? Mitzvah is a commandment, which means either do this or don't do this. They're both commandments. Don't murder is also a mitzvah, because it says don't murder.
But then have we got sloppy with that word then when we say, if you do this, it's a mitzvah?
Yes. Yes, we have got sloppy with the word.
Okay.
Right, yeah. An act of kindness is a mitzvah. Not every mitzvah is an act of kindness. That's the...
Okay.
Right. So there's a mitzvah of do not... It's called a mitzvah, a command of God. Do not, as a king should not take too many wives.
Okay.
Shlomo said, well, it doesn't apply to me because it says the reason in the Torah, and the reason doesn't apply to me anymore. So not only was that a wrong decision to make, but we see the reason did apply to him, right? God showed him that my reasons in the Torah are correct, and you have no right to decide that you're beyond the reasoning the Torah gives. So that's part of the reason why the Torah does not give reasons for mitzvahs, because it can lead us astray. It can make us make our own decisions. Well, this mitzvah says the reason is X. That reason doesn't really apply anymore. It doesn't apply to me. It doesn't make sense to me. So I'm not going to perform that mitzvah. So we can't make that decision because, number one, it's the will of God. Number two, any reason that we do have may only be one reason out of many, which is a common understanding we have throughout the works of the Talmud and the Midrashim, that there's many, many reasons for every single mitzvah. Even if we can accomplish understanding two reasons for mitzvah, there might be another 24 that we don't know about. On many, many levels. So therefore, you can never take any reason that you do understand of a mitzvah and say, well, that's the reason, doesn't apply, so I'm going to move past that mitzvah. Does that, yeah.
You said the Torah, for three mitzvahs, the Torah gives a reason, and then you listed these three about the halakhas of Malachim. Are you saying these are the three that you mentioned?
Well, there's more than three, but these are three of them. The Gemara points out that there are three that are relate to the Melech, which Shlomo took into mind. Yeah.
And what was money?
And what do you say about money? It says, I'll read it from here.
Here are three.
actually, it doesn't say what he did with the money. If I can find here. It only mentions those two, which he actually stumbled on. So it doesn't mention about the money. So it could be that the money one he did not violate. But those two, at least, the Gemara says that he made that decision, he violated them, and it backfired. So
maybe he needed the money for trading the horse,
Right.
I mean, something happened there.
So that's a good question. These laws of kings, are they counted in 613?
Yeah, they are.
Oh, they are.
Yeah. So, which is right, no one human being could actually do all 613. Unless you're simultaneously a man and a woman, a king, a Kohen, a Levi, a convert, a criminal. unless that all applies to one person.
Important point, because when people are introduced to Judaism, they tell people there's 613 mitzvahs, and sometimes they neglect
it. It's a little overwhelming. Those which apply to us nowadays, to one individual person, it's probably 150 or something. Some only in the temple, some only in Israel, some only. Yeah, right. So you could whittle it down to a lot less than there are.
It makes it a lot easier to be Jewish.
Yeah.
It does. 630, and you have to do them all. Now, and you have to do them now.
So Sefer Chanukah continues. He says that we certainly have the right to discuss mitzvahs, explain their reasons, assuming it fits into the context of the Torah, the laws of the mitzvah. We can't just make up things that don't fit in. But I mean, Rav Hirsch writes that if you look at the mitzvah, you look at all of its laws, and you can think of one concept that seems to fit the entire picture. So that's a valid reason of the mitzvah, not the reason, not the only reason. You can't make a decision based on that reason. But if you want to pull that out as a meaning and a way to inspire yourself and a message of the Torah, you can do that. That's valid, because we're allowed to offer reasons for mitzvahs, because as long as it fits into the context of the mitzvah itself. But the mitzvah has many layers and many, it has a lot of depth, many layers of meaning. And therefore, we can definitely offer our own understanding of a mitzvah, assuming it fits into the picture, to the big picture. So that's his introduction to Tumah Tahara. So he finally says, well, Tumah, this idea of ritual impurity, which is beyond us, we don't quite get it. He says that, number one, we have to trust God that Tumah does affect and damage the soul in some way. It's a spiritual impurity. It's not a physical impurity. It's a spiritual impurity. The way I explain to my kids, that just like the shower cleans the body, the mikvah cleans the soul. And the mikvah is the way you clean your soul. We don't see the dirt on the soul either, but the mikvah is the way we understand. That's what the Torah tells us. The mikvah is something we should clean the soul. The soul can become dirty in some way, in a spiritual way. It can become clean in a spiritual way. So Sefer Chanukah writes, we have to understand, number one, even though we don't know how it works, the Tumah does, in some way, damage the soul. The Gemara tells us, based on a verse which you have in Parshas Shmini, it talks about both eating and becoming impure through different forbidden animals, such as like reptiles, amphibians, those types of things, which in Torah law, there's no permitted reptile or amphibian which one can eat. And also, there's eight what are called shratzim. The eight shratzim are eight types of animals which make someone impure. It's a dispute as to what those are in modern language, but they essentially are different types of rodents and reptiles, more or less. You can look at different commentaries describing these shratzim. But the Torah says that don't get yourself involved in these things, because it's going to affect you. It says venit mesembam. The word venit mesembam, the simple translation would be, and you'll become tameh, you'll become impure through them. But when the word is mentioned in the Torah, it's missing a letter. It's missing the letter aleph. So venit mesembam, missing the letter aleph, can be read also as the word venitam tembam. Tam means you'll be sealed up. It'll close you up. It'll clog you. And the Gemara says that's one valid understanding of this verse, that these things will kind of clog you. And the way it's understood, it's explained by the Sefer HaKinuch, explains that, his wording, I'll translate his words, he says that the springs of your intellect, which connect to your soul, are going to be damaged somewhat through the Tumah. Meaning somehow it can block a person. Like a person can have a clogged artery. Physically, a person with a heart attack, you can also clog up your soul. Your connection with God, your soul can be clogged. Your soul can have blockage. Really any sin can do that, but even non-kosher food is one of the main things which can cause a spiritual blockage. That's what's pointed out.
Psychological.
psychological, spiritual, you know, we all, you know. And he says, just like we know, I guess even his science in their days could understand that certain types of foods can affect the emotions, even though it's not, you don't really see a physical connection per se. I mean, nowadays they could probably figure it out based on different hormones, things like that. So too, different foods affect the soul's connection to God. And the Jewish soul should be very sensitive to spirituality, but the more a person is involved in sins, things which cause this idea of timtum, this way that a person gets closed off, you become less sensitive to God, less sensitive to spirituality. I want to share with you, before we finish, just a deeper understanding of this. I heard in a lecture from Rabbi Moshe Wolfson. Rabbi Moshe Wolfson is a very scholarly Jewish thinker, lives in New York. He used to teach, I think he still does, at the Yeshiva Torah Vadas in Brooklyn. And one of the people I really enjoy listening to, just, he's a very, very, very deep and emotional speaker. He has a shul in Brooklyn, it's called, I think, Munas Yisrael, I think it's a shul, it's in Borough Park. But he speaks there every week. So I was listening to a lecture of his, and he says that, you know, every single Jew inherits from the patriarchs and matriarchs a certain connection to God in the DNA. We have physical DNA, there are physical, you know, ancestors, and therefore, just like a parent passes on to a child hair color, eye color, other the physical traits, so also a parent can pass on certain spiritual traits. The fact that we refer to Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah as our avos and imos, our matriarchs and patriarchs, that's because they pass on to spiritual traits. What is the primary spiritual trait passed on to us, especially from Abraham and then from all of them, is what we call emunah, this faith in God. He says faith in God isn't just intellectual. There's an instinct in a Jew to believe in God, to feel connection with God. It's a fact. It's a fact in a Jewish life. A baby Jewish child has in them an instinct to connect with God. That's what he says. It's very interesting that when the Torah presents us the mitzvah of belief in God, the very first Ten Commandments, it doesn't give us a command, you shall believe in God. It's a statement. I am the Lord your God. Why is it a statement? Because it's a fact. It's not something we have to do. It's innate in every single Jew. Every single Jew has it innately within them. It's instinctual. He says, just like you take an animal, and a bee knows how to build a beehive, and a beaver can build a dam, it was never taught how to do so, it's just, you know, it's knowledge which is just inside the animal. So in a Jew, there's something called emunah, and it's something which is instinctual within every single Jew. So what happens then? We know out there, unfortunately, there are many Jews who don't connect with God and don't believe. What happened to those Jews? So he writes that in Hebrew, when we call somebody who denies God, the word used is a kofar. Kofar. The word kofar is the same word used. It says that when Noah built the ark, the chafarta osa be, the, I think, whatever material, it means to cover, right? The chafarta means to cover something. The kapores is the covering over the ark, the temple. It was a covering. Because a kofar, one who denies God, really the word means to cover up. It's a cover up. Because the Jew has in them belief in God, deep down in their heart. But people are able to cover that belief up. They don't destroy it, they don't tear it out of them. It's there. It's covered. Kofar. It's covered up. The person is covering up their belief in God. Some sins, moving, you know, acting against God's will, as we said, creates a timtum, creates this clog in a person. And that clog is what blocks the Jewish heart on a spiritual level from connecting with God. It's a clogged artery in a spiritual way. That's what sin can do. And the more and more a Jew is involved in not following God's will, that Jew becomes more distant from God, not because they don't have an innate belief in God within them, but because they've covered it up based on their actions. It's become covered. Not necessarily even based on their own decision to cover up, but some people, that's just the life they're born into. That's what they're taught. And therefore, that connection to God is covered up and blocked, even though it's naturally there. That's why we talk about every Jew has what's something we call a pitzel yin inside, that little point of Jewish sanctity, which is there, and every single, even the Jew, which is the most removed, most assimilated, most unaffiliated, even that Jew has that little point within, which keeps them connected to God.
What's that word again, please?
It's a Yiddish word, pitzelayid. The Jewish point in a person, I guess the translation. That's why, I mean, many point out, you know, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Baal Tanya, writes that you find that even Jews that were totally estranged from Judaism, when they were given the choice, you know, the cross or death, would give their lives. Where is that coming from? I mean, they lived a life, assimilated life, a secular life, not at all connected to the Jewish community. But deep down, there's an innate belief in every Jew, which, when they're put to the test, can come out. So when these Jews who were totally unaffiliated were given the choice, okay, you can convert or die, they would die for God. They would die al Kiddush Hashem, the sanctity of God.
You know, I know someone who, a man who married someone who wasn't Jewish, and he told one of his relatives, when he dies, though, he wants to be buried in the Jewish cemetery.
Right. There's something there, which every Jew has. Yeah. In life, he didn't feel a connection, but you know, but there's something inside every single Jew which is naturally there, passed on from the patriarchs. The first blessing of Shema Esrei, we end Baruch Atah Hashem Magen Avraham, the shield of Abraham. So in Hasidic thought, the Kedush Rim writes that what's the shield of Abraham? Each one of us has in ourselves a shielded off part from Abraham, which cannot be affected. And there's this part of us which is from Abraham, which is there, which maintains that connection to God, that faith, despite our actions. And our actions can cover it up. A person can be a kofir, they can cover up their action, they can cover up that point from Abraham, they can cover up that belief. But they can't take it out of themselves. And it's there. So if we understand it that way, we have a deeper understanding of the whole idea of tumma and this idea of timtum, of clogging up a person in general. The tumma is something, we don't know how it works. But when it becomes tame, the rabbi's teaching us, it creates a spiritual clog in a person. And it may be okay to become tame. The Torah says you're not allowed to become tame. But there's nothing considered virtuous to remain tahor, because tumma can create timtum. Timtum means this clog, a blockage. And the person will be less connected to God based on this timtum. As a person lives a life based on the will of God and repents, so they're taking off those layers of, that are blocking that point of that Jewish point within them, that emunah within them, that faith in God that's deep within every Jew. You remove those layers, and the person is naturally connected to God once again.
So when King Solomon violated those three laws of kings, that he was creating this.
Even he created a timtum. Yeah.
And my question is, after that, he wrote Ecclesiastes, right?
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if he wrote that after he
Revelation. Good question. I don't know the exact chronology.
Yeah.
That's an interesting question.
Again, he was allowed to build a temple.
Well, that was before. Right. He built the temple before he had his issues. These are after. Yeah. This is in his old age, it says. This is when he became older, his wives led him astray.
Okay.
But when he was younger, he built the temple. So that's something. So tumma, again, we don't understand how it works. We don't know what it means, but it affects a person spiritually. Every Jew has an innate connection to God. We can clog that connection, and we can also create a bypass, and we can clear up our arteries, and we can therefore connect to God once again. Many Jews who do live assimilated lives make a decision to become more attached to the Torah, more observant. So sometimes it's a very quick change. Suddenly they feel very connected and very inspired by the Torah once again, because it's all there in the person. It has to be brought out. It has to be uncovered. And once you uncover it, it's right there. So we're out of time. I wanted to read you something else from the Rambam. I think we're out of time for the day. But ultimately, we see two different important points in the realm of Tumah and Tahara. Number one was the Rambam's point, which was that every single person wants to keep the approach to the Beis HaMikdash fresh. So God said, okay, we're going to limit who can enter in, so you keep it fresh. And the second point, after the Sefer HaChinuch's long introduction to this mitzvah, he points out that whether we understand it or not, tumah affects a person. It damages the soul, creates a blockage. The person is less sensitive to God. And there are certain mitzvahs which are certain violations which are more likely to create blockages, certain less. But every single sin does create this blockage. Just like in food, you know, many types of foods can cause someone to have clogged arteries, but certain foods are more likely to cause that than others. So too in the world of mitzvos, their prohibitions in the Torah, certain mitzvos are more likely, if you violate them, more likely to cause a blockage, some less likely. In particular, it does say that tumah and eating non-kosher food, those create a blockage more so than other types of violations. That does seem to be clear from the Torah. But this blockage is there over this innate, instinctual belief in God every single person has. And our job is to try not to clog our own spiritual arteries, try to remove that clog and connect to God with that sensitivity of the Jewish soul, which we all have in us from Abraham, from the patriarchs and matriarchs. Yeah.
There's a lot of prohibitions about foods and eating, but I don't think the Torah uses the word kosher. My question is, really, what's the first usage of the word kosher?
I mean, that word is used in the Talmud. It's definitely used there. I don't think it's used here. Right? It's not used in the Torah itself.
I think its root meaning is properly prepared for a Torah's intended use.
Right. Yeah.
So you talk not just about who, a safer tofer, safer tofer, kosher, your sukkah is kosher.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
You're right.
The word
kosher is, it's like our saying, it's prepared. It's prepared appropriately.
That's what it means.
And the Talmud. Yeah. Talmud is it. Yeah, I think you're right. That's not used anywhere in the Torah itself. Mishnah uses it.
Yeah.
Kosher, pasul. Yeah. Pasul and kosher go together. Right. Right, so maybe next week. I'll share this Rambam with you next week. We're over time today.
What do people hate now that they don't have the red pepper? And they do go to the funeral of their parents.
Nothing.
But then they don't go, they get over eventually
because
they don't go again if somebody else dies.
Yeah, no, but even once they're tummy, they're not allowed to further themselves into the switch again. They've got more tummy. If they have no way to get out of it, it never fades off. Once you're tummy, until you go through the proper procedure, you're still tummy. Right. But they're still not allowed to subject themselves to more tummy, regardless. Right. No problem. Thank you for getting it. Yeah, except the baby. He needs to get a new one now. Yeah. And my wife's all
interested. When was the last time we were at the Heifer?
I don't know.
But you weren't there.
I was not there, that's for sure. They didn't have the second temple there. I don't know when the final one actually was there.
So it's just when it comes there. Islam, Kafir is an unbeliever.
Uh-huh. It's the same exact
thing. Yeah, it's just destructive. Right.
I think the rabbis say the only 10 kosher red heifers in history.
Oh.
And the 10th one's going to be on Mashiach, actually. So, there weren't some money. They saved the ashes. I mean, the ashes go a long way. You don't need some of the ashes for those things. So, they go a long way.
Well, you got more people. Yeah. My granddaughter.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you. Well, the other thing is, in a few research, what you said was reinforced by what Pew Research, where an unhealthy large percentage of people call themselves, which are not affiliated, it's like no real belief system. However, Pew Research, something like 40% or something, still have that, they didn't use the word Pinto, but they still have that spark of Judaism. So underneath, no secular, no religious beliefs, no culture, no nothing. But yet, underneath, it's there. Right. That's what the Pew just came out about two or three months ago.
Right.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard the term bagel-ing? You hear that term before?
Bagel-ing.
No. You ever go out to, like, a store, and somebody knows you're Jewish, and you don't realize they're Jewish, and try to say some sort of Yiddish phrase to you, so just so you know they're Jewish? Yeah. I walk in with my yarmulke into, like, Giant. So a lady walked by. You know, the matzah is really good this year on the show. That's a lady. You know,
that's probably the only Hebrew word. Or
they want you to know they're Jewish. You know,
it's also think about kosher food. Once I had a, I was working for a Chinese guy,
Ross, and
a
lawyer. That's correct. Kosher Chinese food. Yeah.
The lawyer for the company says, you know, they start ordering a lot of soup. He says, where's the kosher food? He said, it's all kosher. But what he's thinking is, where's the deli food?
That's
the thing.
They can kosher food
in
the deli.
Oh. Well, tomorrow night they're going to Royal Grand.
Yeah, that's Chinese food. I mean, that's just, people are funny. Don't they say, like, you're a New Yorker or something? That's like
somebody coined this term.
Bagel?
I've never
heard of it.
And what is it? When a Jew who's not recognizably Jewish, knows you're Jewish, wants to know they're Jewish. So they come over to you and they tell you some sort of Jewish phrase, Hebrew word, Yiddish word. You know.
Just so you know they're Jewish.
They want an image.
Yeah. All right, good seeing you, Warren.
Good seeing you,
Warren. Oh, thank you.
Don't you dare say anything.
You know, what you said is, maybe you want to build this into your arsenal of stories, but there's a thing from Rabbi Kulabach, I'll give you, where he writes about this type of Hanukkah. We've had many classes on Hanukkah, and you know, you're not supposed to, lo mishto mesh bahem, in other words, when you look at the candle, you're not supposed to use it for anything.
Right.
You're just supposed to sit and enjoy the beauty of it.
Right.
And so, this teaches us that, you know, when you look at people, you're not supposed to. Most people are in this mode of thinking that says, like, exactly this is more like, is this good for me or is this not good for me? That's what people. But that's what the Hanukkah light is teaching us. Is that you're not supposed to, like, all the time be doing that. You're supposed to only look at it. Don't you just look at it and don't think, is this person good or not? Can I use the person?
Right.
Just look at the person and say, here's a thing of beauty, and just look at them without judgment. That's a Shlomo. I almost burst in there, but I mean, I was thinking, okay, now I can give it over to you because that's what the lesson of the Hanukkah candle is. That's what he brought out of it. It is. It's the kind of thing I don't think you get in a regular yeshiva. That's a Shlomo Torah, basically. That's, in other words, you were saying, well, you learned that from the Torah, but he's saying that that's specifically the lesson of just look at it and enjoy it and don't think, is it good for me or bad for me?
Right.
It's still got here. No, it's not full of tourists. Oh, it could be a white, whatever. Oh, this learning should know. I was thinking also, just my trip to Israel is kind of strengthening observance. You go to different shuls, you go to see how different people, they work the prayer system. Now, it's kind of like, you change the situation where you don't do things the same way that you do, and yet you have people of Amuna, and doing it, you can see it kind of causes you to refresh and awaken your own practices.
Sort of
that's fine. But there's a little cutoff way where you can go by Whiteland Station.
Yes, you can show me. I don't know exactly.
Yeah, okay. Sure. Yeah, hello? Yeah, I'm driving with my rabbi teacher from the class, yeah. You ever go to any classes, like once a week or something, like a special class? That's another thing to do, to get